critical thinking for everyone.
To all of our listeners, old and new, we are so glad that you decided to tune in, or maybe you hit the play button on SoundCloud, you intrepid listener, you.
Oh, yeah, we have a lot of smart folks, really clever out there, making moves.
Yeah.
Pushing buttons.
Yeah. Everywhere. And we are here to push your buttons in the best ways, well, and as thinkers.
Critical thinking is subversive. We can't forget. I mean, that's why it's not taught a lot in elementary school. It's not like standing in line, right? It's like the opposite of that. So you just want to keep in mind that, you know, there's a lot going on here that maybe gets to come at it in pieces or something.
It's subversive if you're doing it right.
That's right. Well, right? Maybe it's just subversive in tone even. I don't know.
Well, we are going to go on an adventure today, listeners, because we have, for the first time in a long time, maybe since before COVID?
We had all these public health visitors.
During COVID,
yeah,
right.
We
love to bring guests on the show, smart thinkers who are our friends and colleagues, to bring them on the show and pick their brains and ask them all these questions and like try to squeeze all the juice out of them and share it with you.
Yeah.
And we did a ton of public health stuff during COVID. Yep. But since then, we not so much.
Right. And there aren't good reasons for that.
No good reason other than we're just, you know, we're lazy. Maybe.
I am. I don't know how we get this done if we're both lazy. Anyway, if you want to be a guest, not just our friends. Our friends can whatever reach out to us. But if you want to be a guest, I mean, Critical Thinking for Everyone. That is the name of the show, in case you missed the hollered intro. This is Critical Thinking for Everyone, and you have been listening to the dulcet tones of my co-host, Dr. Patty Payette.
And I am right here with my esteemed co-host, Dr. Brian Barnes.
Yes, indeed. And we are trying to bring critical thinking ideas to the people, for everyone. The premise is, for the show, the premise is that critical thinking is something that applies to everyone and to all content, and that we ought to be able to do it in real time without extra tools, just the stuff in our head. And so, for those of you who haven't spent much time on the show, we're often talking about critical thinking as thinking about your thinking while you're thinking in order to improve your thinking. And that's just one definition. It's one that we find very easy to get into, because while we're on the show, we're going to be trying to think about our own thinking and other thinking in real time. And our goal always is the improvement of thinking. So welcome. And today's going to be awesome.
Today's going to be awesome because our guest is Matt Gatton. Welcome, Matt.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
We are so happy to have you here talking about your new book called The Shadows of Socrates, The Heresy, War, and Treachery Behind the Trial of Socrates. Dun, dun, dun.
And let me just say, before we hear more about Matt, which we're going to focus on a lot of stuff about him and his book for this show, I just want to mention that there is a critical thinking connection with Socrates. Are you familiar with this?
What do you mean a critical thinking connection with Socrates? You mean that exists?
Well, the one in our critical thinking system, in the Paul Elder critical thinking system that we're always talking about. There's
an explicit connection to Socrates?
Yeah.
Not Socratic questioning.
Well, that's explicit.
But no, what?
There's a foundational idea. See, the thing is, this trial that Matt has written this very nice book about, we're not on TV, I don't have to show the book. Anyway, the trial that Matt's written this very nice book about is related directly to Socrates, who is, for many people, a seminal figure in the beginning of Western philosophy, and in particular, in the study of ethics and the relationship between the people and the state. One aspect of that, at least as we get it through Plato, which we've talked about a bunch of times on the show, right?
Yeah.
One of the aspects of that is this questioning method that, you know, made Socrates so famous. That's the intellectual and historical point that the founder of the critical thinking system, Dr. Richard Paul, goes to when he starts talking about what is critical thinking. He sees Socrates demanding criteria. And that's where he makes the connection. And so he would say that even though there wasn't a field of critical thinking until like the 1960s or something, he would say that, you know, Socrates is the first critical thinker in the tradition, the first thinker who we know explicitly was concerned about these things. And I think that's a neat connection to bring somebody on who's going to talk to us about Socrates.
That is interesting.
Surprised you, huh?
You did.
It's for everyone.
Well,
Matt,
Matt. So, yes, we want to hear from Matt. And I need to first say, Matt, I want to talk a bit about you. And you are talking to us from your home base in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Indeed.
But you spent some of your formative growing up years, or many of them, in Louisville, right here in Louisville, Kentucky.
In the Ville, absolutely.
Yeah. And
where's
that's where
high school. I already know.
Yeah. That's where our paths crossed.
Oh yeah, Atherton alone.
Yeah. So, okay. Matt and his siblings and my siblings, we all went to Atherton, and which is how we know each other. And so when I then ran into Matt's mom and sister last month, and it came up in conversation that Matt had this new book and Socrates, of course, I was like immediate, like what? What is this is, ooh, I must look into this. So Matt, according to your bio here, it says you are a pioneer of the study of the ritual and aesthetic uses of physical light in prehistory and classical antiquity. Wow, I gotta just ask you, how did you get interested in that, the ritual and aesthetic uses of physical light?
Whoa, okay, well that starts super early as a real deal art nerd. So when I was a kid, there was this picture on this wall of this deceased great grandparent. It was a black and white image of my great-grandfather. It was in one of those oval frames with one of those convex glass lenses. Do you remember those things?
Yeah. And
I would stare in that thing with just wonder, because depending on how you moved around it, it had sort of a 3D effect. So, and of course the house was stacked floor to ceilings with books. So I've got way into ancient Greek things from my Greek great-grandfather, and so the way some kids get into dinosaurs, I got into ancient Greek stuff to the extent that in grammar school, when the teacher asked us which famous person, living or dead, would you most like to have a conversation with, just for context, all the other boys in the class picked Evel Knievel. but I picked Phidias, the great Greek sculptor who made the monumental Athena that was in the centerpiece of the Parthenon.
Oh!
So, yeah, I was a very nerdy little boy, and I probably would have gotten beaten up a lot at Bloom Elementary if I hadn't been the class dodgeball king. So, yeah.
Okay.
Let me follow up with you, dodgeball king.
All right.
I had a question about that. So what was it about Phidias that you would want to converse?
Oh, the idea of making a sculpture that large. So the thing about ancient Greek sculptures is that they were wonders. They were thauma, T-H-A-U-M-A. So the surface treatment of ancient Greek sculptures made them seem more alive than they were. So the whole concept that you could make such an amazing sculpture at that scale, inside that important building. So I think to understand the Parthenon, you A, have to go to the Acropolis in Athens to see its context, and then you need to drive down I-65 to Nashville, where there's that complete concrete reproduction.
Yeah.
So you have to sort of do both to get the real sense. And luckily, being in the Ville, you could pretty rapidly annoy your mom enough to drive you to Nashville.
Yeah.
Now, let me ask you this. I, we are known in this show for going down rabbit holes, and we got to be careful because we got Matt for a precious amount of time
here. We're going to make it back. We're just
working. And I got to be careful on the rabbit holes. Right. But when you mentioned that, it made me think of the Louisville sculptor Enid Yundell.
Yeah.
And her sculptures of like classical figures. And she didn't she create she created for the World's Fair enormous, was it Athena? I think so.
I mean, I think our University of Louisville's got the Minerva thing going on, so yeah.
Yeah. So anyway,
the World's Fair per se. But yeah, it seemed like it.
Yeah. So anyway,
I didn't know everything.
Yeah. So Matt, you were hooked really, really early on Greek antiquities and
yeah, Greek- just that Greek family line. And then I got into I was a mass communications teacher. I taught a lot of studio art, photography, video, sculpture, drawing, painting. And then I got looped in with some archaeologists who had questions about light, how light would play in ancient structures. Mm. So I began working with Paleolithic habitation sites, and then got sort of drug into the Neolithic world. And then my colleague, Walter Brock, who had studied under Guy Davenport at the University of Kentucky.
I know Walter Brock.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so Walter says to me, he's like, how is there a way to explain how Persephone, the goddess who is celebrated at the Mysteries of Eleusis, famous rite in ancient Athenian culture, that went on for almost 2,000 years. His question was, you know, she shows up as a phasmatophos. She shows up as an apparition of light. Can you explain how that was done physically? Like, we understand mythologically how it's supposed to work, but...
Sure.
So then we sort of went to work trying to piece that all together based on epigraphical accounts. You know, I went and visited the ruins, tried to, you know, mark it all off and figure out. So it took some time. And then that research was published in the Handbook of Light and Archaeology with Oxford University Press. So even though the research was done in 2006 and they approached me in 2011 and I was the first person through peer review by 2014, the book wasn't physically printed until 2022. Wow. That's kind of impressive for you.
So, exactly.
All the little details about everything, that's in this academic tome that'll cost you $400. So yeah.
Well, so you got into this work, it sounds like, through your sort of interest in ancient Greece when you were young, and then in through the various media that you know, art as an artist, and then, as you said, you crossed disciplines and started talking with other scholars and practitioners in other fields, and it sounds like your work really deepened and went in some really interesting directions. Sounds really fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely unexpected. Absolutely unexpected.
Really? Totally unexpected?
Yeah, but when it sort of circled around to writing this book, it felt like I was coming home.
Okay, can you talk more about that?
Right, so this interest in sculpture and being an artist, it's a, you would not think that that has a lot to do with light until you get into how the Mysteries of Eleusis functioned. And that is a song written in light and sculpture. So maybe we need to preface the audience as to what the Mysteries of Eleusis.
Yes.
Was. Oh yeah. Cause nobody has any idea.
Yeah. So that's how you start off your book, which right. was really helpful.
Yeah, so it's a forgotten, obscure religious ritual that was sort of the heartbeat of ancient Athens. It was, however, secret. If, after having attended the ritual, you did so much as spoke about it, you committed a capital offense. So you would be killed and all your possessions would be taken by the state. And in future processions to the temple, they would put up these stela, these standing stones that would list the names of the profaners and list the inventory of all the things that they owned that were taken by the state because of their sin.
Mm.
You are not allowed to talk about the mysteries of Eleusis. So that's why it was a difficult nut to crack. Now, the Roman Emperor Theodosius outlaws the mysteries as we're moving on to about 400 of the Common Era. And this ritual started sometime before 1500 BCE.
Wow.
Now, there are mystery cults all over the ancient world. But this Eleusis is the Super Bowl of mystery cults. Like, it is the ace number one. It will, I don't know what its Nielsen rating was, but it must have been crazy. So up to 3,000 people can be initiated in one evening. The Roman emperors come to get initiated. People come from all over the world, all over the Mediterranean world to get initiated. So the initiation involves a march through Hades. So you have to have like this horrific, terrifying experience in the dark of, that you are going to the realm of the dead. And then if you survive that, because apparently it's very painful and awful, that then you would come up into this realm of beatific visions, where the goddess would then bestow a blissful afterlife upon you. So the reason people want to get initiated is so because they want bliss after they die. So in the ancient Greek conception, Hades is not necessarily the greatest place to be, but there's an island in the river called the Elysium, which is heaven, and that's where the bliss is, and that's where Persephone will put you when you die. She's the goddess of both the underworld and the overworld, and that's a very interesting story how that ends up happening. But so what they're selling is the afterlife, it was just so there's a paucity of direct testimonials until after around the time it's outlawed. Then you get people, you know, piping up about what happened inside.
Spilling the beans.
Of Alexandria. There's a number of them who are, because it gets the mystery religions get replaced with Christianity. So then you have the early Christian commentators who are more than happy to tell you what a scam Eleusis was.
Okay, that's important. Thank you. That's an important piece for me to help me understand the where it fits in his sort of kind of historical and religious thinking. So thank you. That's really helpful. And I really appreciated that you started the book off with this explanation, because it's woven through the book and helps us understand, as you allude to throughout the book, at sort of the trial and death of Socrates, all of these important events, how they led up to, and how Socrates was sort of caught up in these political and, these bigger forces that it's really fascinating. Because I think now, I will say one thing about the book is, I think now we think of Socrates is sort of this like superhuman being. And what you have done in the book is, for me, made him a human being. And you've brought him and you've helped me understand him as a person in his time. And
crazy it was.
And oh,
crazy time it was. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So thank you for that, for really helping me give that context. And understand also Athens as this paradoxical place. Now, again, we think of ancient in Greece, and I think of Athens as this like hotbed of like, you know, philosophical, you know, cradle of philosophical reasoning and art and all, you know, and then yet your book lifts the veil and we see the human foibles and the struggles and the power plays, And we, again, you sort of humanize that. It's really fascinating.
It's a really nice narrative for sure.
Yeah, I love the bit where Socrates is talking to his petulant preteen son who's mad at his mom. You know, that's like, that's, yeah.
Yeah, you're like, some things never change.
That's right. That's right. You know, but that, yeah, so, yeah, his relationship to the mysteries of Eleusis is sort of the way in to understanding ultimately what happens to him. I like to say that trying to discuss what happened to Socrates without discussing the mysteries of Eleusis is like trying to talk about what happened to Galileo without talking about the Catholic Church. Like, you have to understand the religious context in which he lived and how at some point he becomes willing to take them on and launch the first real battle of philosophy versus religion.
So I have a few questions just about this particular piece. I've spent a lot of time looking at this kind of material from kind of a Western civ point of view, I guess, you know, humanities. This is Athens, you know, all of these features. Certainly the story of Socrates is familiar to me and you know, in one telling. Those narratives, I guess, that I've been familiar with before have not mentioned the rites as being central. And so I find that much of what I'm sort of following along in the book, I'm hitting a lot of bumps kind of in my experience of the story, which, you know, is by no means exhaustive. And I'm certainly not asking because I have answers. I'm asking because I have questions.
Right.
Why would you say that these rites, which you, mm-hmm. you know, you make really central to this narrative here, why would you say that they've been excluded since they've been, you know, in the public record, if you will, for 1700 years or 1600 years or whatever? A lot of people have written about this and told this story since then. Why do folks leave them out, do you think?
Right. So two issues. One is this book is a new explanation. If you grew up the standard explanation, then this is like, wait, what? So,
right.
But to answer your question, the issue is the academization. It's about, the problem is the compartmentalization of information. So if you read Thucydides, you read the Peloponnesian War, that's in the history category. Read the dialogues, that's over here in philosophy.
Sure.
If you want to study the religion, well, that's over here in Mythologyville. If you want to study the art, to synthesize or integrate all this information is a Herculean task. I mean, it took me 20 years to do it. But the point is, I mean, there are a lot of people who've read and studied all the source material. And I was speaking to one professor the other day. He's like, how'd you make these connections? Because I love this stuff. I live this stuff. I never saw the, but now that you show me, it's like, oh, but of course, you know. So to answer your question, it's because it's in a different field. It's in a different domain.
That's,
and as much as we love, we talk about cross-disciplinary work in academics, they really don't like it.
Well, sometimes.
Fascinating.
Sometimes.
That's fascinating.
But let me just follow up with this, because this might be really helpful. It certainly be helpful for me if we can just pursue this for a second. So I would say that in the narrative that I've received or whatever, which again, I don't consider authoritative by any stretch. That's just the narrative I've received.
Right.
I would say that the cult of Apollo per se plays an important role through the Oracle of Delphi. You know, and that, you know, the proclamation from the oracle about Socrates, sort of traditionally setting him on his quest, if you will, full time, leading to all of the things that, you know, it led to or whatever. That strikes me as...
But just to point out, following the oracle Delphi,
yeah,
is what you were supposed to do. That's not bad. That's
oh no,
heresy.
Oh yeah, and I wasn't suggesting that. I was just suggesting that that's religion. Like all of that is so that like that's an interdisciplinary. Like you can't have the story of Socrates. He was on a mission from God, right? He was
like the Blues Brothers
for sure. I mean, I've always characterized. I think so, right? And I mean, if anything that I say that you don't agree with, please let me know. But I mean, and then of course the Oracle and its. Institutional religious role, right? I mean, it just seems like you can't divorce the philosophical story from the religion in the first place and tell the story. It seems like it's necessarily interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary. I mean,
right.
I just wonder why you, maybe you haven't wondered about this, but I just wonder why that aspect of religion gets left in all the time and people didn't talk about all this stuff.
I think because, you know, this reconstruction archaeology breakthrough about how the mysteries operated just happened. It was just...
Okay, that's what I was wondering. So this is really fresh knowledge.
Yeah.
What you're saying with your publication with Oxford University Press. Like people wouldn't know about this unless you read, you know, some 6th century sources or...
So it's new. It's kind of a new,
is that right?
A new perspective. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. A new perspective in that once I figured out how using a sculpture, a light source, and an aperture, you could use a simple optical technique to make the goddess appear as light.
Yeah, cool.
So the way to think about this Temple of Eleusis is like a high school basketball arena with a little shotgun house at center court. It is darkest pitch out in a basketball arena, but there's some incredibly bright fire inside the shotgun house and sculptures of the goddess, and only the priest can go in there. And you put those two together, you can project the image of that sculpture out into the darkened telestrion. So
is that a camera obscura?
Yeah, simple camera obscura, but you're sort of reversing the size of, you know, normally it's strong daylight coming into a house through a keyhole or something. But this is a carefully arranged optical apparatus. And for people 2,000 years ago who saw a movie, this is mind-blowing. The goddess shows up and says, you did it. You survived. You did. I welcome you to the Elysium when you die. And then, of course, the people, when they leave, they feel better about life and the afterlife. I mean, that's what they gain from this experience. I mean, it was the most mind-altering thing in the ancient world. And of course, all these other satellite mystery religions would come and study at Eleusis, or Eleusinian priests would go and coach up other sects all over the place. So the thing about this obscure ritual is that you're able to figure out how idolatry worked.
Sure.
And then, because the idea was people didn't actually worship the clearly human-made sculpture. They believed the deity resided in it and could come out. So the key to the whole thing is the mystics have to be able to have it come out in some sort of ephemeral form. That's the magic of the whole thing. So, but the thing for me is after I figured it out, I read the Allegory of the Cave completely differently. For those who don't know, the Allegory of the Cave, written by Plato, Book 7 of the Republic, is this conversation between Socrates and Glaucon about these people who are strapped to a wall in a cave. And it is the most famous philosophical writing in the history of the Western world.
Sure.
I don't know. If you want to chime in a little bit about what that is for those who don't remember.
Yeah.
Well, feel free.
I'll say you two correct me.
Oh, you go.
I'll say
you
what
go.
I think it Great. Is. You two correct me. So The Allegory of the Cave. And so, yeah, so this is Plato wrote this based on Socrates sharing this information, right? So Plato's capturing it in writing years after Socrates' death. And so the Allegory Cave is human beings are in a cave, like chained in a cave, looking at shadows going across the wall in front of them. They cannot move their head. They are just watching shadows of people or things on the wall. And their only understanding is that that is reality, that this must be real. This must be life, because this is the only experience that they have of these shadows. Yep. And then when one person leaves the cave and goes out and begins to see the world begins to see the difference between real things and shadows of things, that person goes back and tries to tell people, well, this is, you're just looking at shadows. This is not what's real. And there are physical things that are real. And those people reject and, do they kill that person or?
Well, he writes, if they could get themselves unchained, they would surely kill that person.
Kill that person.
Right. Yeah. So the idea is they're chained to a wall, behind a wall, or people carrying objects on a pathway, and then there's a fire behind them and it projects whatever they're carrying, sculptures, he says, onto the wall, and then these people believe in shadows. And so this is this incredible metaphor for human existence. It's about divorcing yourself from the world of illusion. It is a description of the philosopher's path to enlightenment. And even though maybe you understand what reality is, you still have a duty to go back down into the cave and argue with people who think you're an idiot, which is exactly what Socrates spent his life doing. But you have that situation again of a fire, a sculpture, a wall, suckers in the dark believe in the shadows. So it is I then interpret it as a thinly veiled description of the actual operations of the mysteries of Eleusis, which again is a capital offense.
Oh yeah, that's complete heresy for sure. Yeah.
Right. And so this,
yeah, absolutely.
So in your book, you use this to help, you use this as one of the reasons that Socrates is on trial and put to death because of his criticism. Right?
Yes. Plato writes it 20 years after Socrates dies. And he lives under the same societal rules, so he has to sort of gloss it over a little bit so he doesn't get the axe himself. Now, I want to change for a second the best reaction I've had to this book, notwithstanding the wonderful arguments I've had about Anytus and Callias and all this other stuff, is one person said to me, "He dies?"
You're bringing the knowledge to the masses. Yeah. Oh, spoiler, huh?
Spoiler alert.
I was like, ruh-roh.
Yeah, wow. Hey, okay, so I've got two questions since you bring up the Allegory of the Cave.
Sure.
So, and I'm sure that others have asked you this question in a much more structured context, because I think these two questions just, I'm very interested to hear what you have to say. So, my understanding of the Allegory of the Cave, of course, the traditional owners, or at least the one that, again, that I have inherited, if you will, is this is Plato doing the things that you said with the Socrates character. You know, it's in the Republic, whatever. It's like, you know, it's a character, but what Plato does with Socrates in that book is he uses him as a mouthpiece for the world of the forms, which of course Socrates could never have known about. since Plato learned about that after Socrates' death. And so I always see, I mean, that's the way that I've understood this, is it's a, that's why it's an allegory, right? I mean, not just because it's about human living, but because like nobody believes in the world of forms. Like this is, because it's of course a, again, the traditional wisdom would have it, it's a Platonic creation, you know, sort of combining Pythagorean theory with this, you know, Socratic training. And so, I mean, do you have any thoughts about the world of the forms connection? Because, I mean, I would just, based on my understanding of it, that would be kind of anachronistic if we applied something like that reality, like that kind of a worldview to Socrates.
Oh, and hey, dear listener, you got some things to say? You'd like, man, this guy didn't know a thing about this. What a waste of thinking. Critical Thinking for Everyone on Facebook. We would love to hear from you, and we would love to discuss these topics with you. Come on to the show. Let's have a conversation about some ancient thinking or whatever. Anyway, hope you're enjoying it.
Right, so there's a caveat page in the beginning where teasing apart Socrates from Plato.
Sure.
People have tried it. It's very difficult because Socrates never wrote anything down.
Right.
Plato wrote the bulk of stuff about Socrates, but there are other authors who write about Socrates.
Sure.
So there's a general sense from those readings that, you know, this is a real flesh and blood guy. He really did say these things. He was a jerk. He was annoying. He was ugly. He smelled bad.
Sure. So, but in all of them, I mean, would you just take all of the dialogues, kind of these present in one way or another an accurate presentation of Socrates, even if none of them are perfect per se? All of them are representative of Socrates?
Right. So the way I left it was, I can't say how much is Plato's invention. How much did Plato accurately remember what his professor had said?
Right.
Sure.
Decades before. I mean, was he following around taking notes? Like, you know, I don't know. So you can say general. If there's a person who could accurately describe Socrates, Plato was in the right position.
Sure.
Can you say every line is exact? No. So I explained that a little bit in the beginning.
Yep,
and then there's the course by which some of these ancient writings made it to us, and some of them did not. You know, we only have like little fragments of anything from around the time of Socrates. I mean, time of Plato.
Right.
So anything else we have from Plato comes from centuries later. You know, the language changes over time. Different people are reinterpreting it or editing. Like, so just anything from that long ago, you have to take with a grain of salt because we weren't there.
Right. Oh, fair. Okay, well, hold on. Let me get my second question.
Okay.
All right, second question. My second question was, what do you do about the argument that people are making today? Because this has been in the media very recently about the camera obscura technology. And what I've heard art historians suggest is that the reason we get accurate proportions at some point in art history, right, much later than what you're suggesting, is because people actually traced the things, right, in some way. They used optics. And so if this kind of thing existed, obviously it's not the same thing, right? I mean, you've mentioned, but if this kind of thing existed, wouldn't somebody have co-opted it and used it over centuries? Wouldn't it have gotten out as a technology that would have been used for other art projects, do you think? Or is it just, was it locked down so tight?
No, technologies come and go, and they have different applications. You know, the camera obscura is used all over this world for all sorts of things, including these eyeballs right here and on you.
Right.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so the Greek fire is another example. You know, that's the terror of the seas. You have this fire that burns underwater. We don't reinvent it. till the 20th century when we make napalm. So technologies come and go. Use of a camera obscura is something that goes back into the mist of time. Of course, Aristotle describes it. When you're dealing with religious applications, you are in the world of secrecy. So there's a fabulous work by Dr. Aaron Watson about use of the simple camera obscura projections in Neolithic passage tombs.
I've seen that one.
I've done with the Paleolithic. So I mean so you have complete photorealism, proportionality and all that stuff in the Magdalenian area, the Paleolithic. Then when cave art disappears, it disappears and then it comes back. Realism comes and goes in these sort of swings.
I'll buy that.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I have so many more questions about your book.
Thank you for entertaining my question.
Yeah.
Go hit him with one.
So I found the chapters about the Peloponnesian War so fascinating.
You did.
I did. Yeah. I was like riveted. I was so riveted. And I guess I missed those details in Mr. Hemesath's class back in Atherton High School, Matt. I don't know if you remember those back in his class, but I was so interested because you portray the maneuvers in the war and the crossings and double crossings and this general is like not sure what to do, and then this this army decides to do this, and then Sparta they're gonna align with Sparta, and then Persia gets involved. Like, it's so fascinating and interesting and detailed in terms of motivations and that kind of thing. And so I was really curious about your how those records were kept and how you stitch that together and what sources, because obviously looking at your bibliography, you had to use a lot of ancient sources.
The bibliography is huge and delicious.
Yeah. So I'm just curious, what was that like? Was there other sources that had done a similar thing and you were sort of filling it in differently? I just was so fascinating to me. Can you talk a little bit about that?
You just have to learn, love digging into footnotes and, checking out different translations and trying to figure out, what is really being said. And that was just a gas. I think in terms of context, I mean, the main sources are Plutarch, Thucydides, Plato, Xenophon, and then there are a whole bunch of other, ones that are peppered in there as needed. Socrates at age 70 gets charged with a religious crime, and he gets charged with corrupting the youth. So the illusus part is the religious part, the impiety part, the not observing the gods, not respecting the gods, making up gods. And then the corrupting the youth part, most scholars say, well, it has something to do with Alcibiades. So you need to know who Alcibiades is.
And
find out who Alcibiades is, you got to get into the Peloponnesian War, because he pretty much keeps it going. So Alcibiades is this rich aristocrat. He's a student of Socrates in his younger day. He's the handsomest man in ancient Athens. He's one of the most persuasive public speakers of all time. He's also a sexual predator. He uses public office for private gain. He tells this incredible lie that causes Athens to take down its democracy. Like, Athens goes from being the crown jewel of the ancient world with its democracy, with its architecture, with its art, with its philosophy, with its medicine, with its technology, to being absolutely starving and crushed and taken over by a foreign power, all because of one man, Alcibiades' fragile, almost childlike ego. So after, in the heyday of Socrates, democracy falls twice. There are two civil wars. Alcibiades is the cause of both of them. And they're going to blame somebody. And the reality is, your teachers, I've been a teacher, the teachers, we get a lot of credit for our high-performing students. For Socrates, that's Plato. But we also take an undue amount of blame for our poor performers. And for Socrates, that's Alcibiades.
And
that's a big pill to swallow.
And so you really do a great job of, as you are describing the twists and turns in the war and Athens grappling with like the rise and fall and the, you know, of democracy. And you really do a great job of helping us set up, like, how is this all going to be related to Socrates, right? Like, you really help us contextualize him, not just as a figure, but as a figure in his own time.
Yeah, I mean, and more than half of Athens dies because of that guy. Like, he's a maneuver. He's all about himself.
Alcibiades, yeah. And you know, and I'm reading this going, did George R.R. Martin, when he was writing Game of Thrones, like, was this his source material? I mean, I'm reading this and I'm thinking, this is like the most crazy episode of, you know, Game of Thrones, which is so much about, but it's history, right? It's ancient history.
Yeah, what Pitch Man said to me, this is Game of Thrones in the Parthenon. And I was like, no, this is Parthenon before Game of Thrones. George R. R. Martin lives right over here, so I see him occasionally. So yeah.
Really? Really? Well, I don't know. Maybe he was like, you know, looking in your recycling and reading your drafts.
He's a well-read gentleman.
I know. I'm teasing. This is no throwing no shade on him, because clearly he is a genius in his storytelling. But
so tell us why it's a love story. Like, just when I started off, I was like, there's a love story in here somewhere. I think it's not a way that people often think about any of this. Can you bring that? I mean, when I think about before this, when I thought about Love in the Ancient World, I was like, well, Symposium maybe, you know, or a few other documents. But what would you say about that?
Man, this book's probably going to get banned in Florida. Yeah, there's some guy on guy. So Alcibiades and Socrates are also lovers for a time. And you can't really understand what happens in ancient Athens unless you understand the relationship of all these people. You got these politicos and these generals and these philosophers and these artists, you know, but they also have romantic relationships. Now, they have wives and they have children. But if you don't know who loves whom and who's the jilted lover, then the whole thing is hard to understand. So Anytus, one of Socrates' accusers, he's, you know, he was the lover of Alcibiades. He's like, the whole thing is just,
wow.
It's out there. So next time, though, we got to talk about the difference between those that know they don't know, those that know they know, those who don't know that they don't know, because that's critical thinking.
Yeah, we could do a whole thing just on critical thinking and maybe Socratic questioning, and that would be a lot of fun.
I think we
unexamined life, et cetera, et cetera.
I think we've just scratched the surface of the conversations we could have with Matt about his work here. For those who didn't catch it in the beginning, it's The Shadows of Socrates. It's published by
Pegasus.
Yeah, Pegasus Books, which is and distributed by Simon & Schuster. Oldsters will remember that name, right? 2024. And this is based on, if you can believe it, some archaeological work that was just published in 2022. This is really, really interesting and groundbreaking, and folks should definitely pick this up and give it a read.
It's a fascinating book, and for those of you who are like, well, I don't have a philosophy background, do not worry. You will dive in, and by chapter one, you're going to be hooked. And Matt, thank you for all of the energy and good thinking and commitment you had in the many years you had writing this book and giving it to the world, because it is a gift. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And I'm sorry he died at the end.
You're not the only
you
one.
You can't change the ending. Yeah, how are you going to do a sequel when he's dead, man?
Dude, I tell you. What? That's where metaphysics comes in.
Well, you see Plato, then we do Aristotle, we just keep rolling.
Yeah,
sure.
Plato, part two, Plato.
Oh, I can't. Yeah, that'll be...
Plato Strikes Back. Yeah, we got it.
Another shadow of Socrates.
Yeah.
Plato.
Yeah, the second shadow.
Anyway, we'd be happy to collaborate all the time with you.
Yeah, just so. We're happy to help you with that when you're ready to brainstorm.
I'll start working on the screenplay.
All right.
Thank you very much, man. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you, Patty.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Enjoyed the show today featuring author Matt Gatton talking about his new book, The Shadows of Socrates, The Heresy, War, and Treachery Behind the Trial of Socrates. If you're interested in learning more about the book, you can visit the website of the publisher, Simon & Schuster, and you can go to simonandschuster.com. That's SimonandSchuster.com. And you can search for The Shadows of Socrates, or I found it just through Googling The Shadows of Socrates publisher. On that website, you will also have an opportunity to look at the resources and downloads, reviews, product details, learn a little bit more about Matt. There's a link where you can buy the book directly from the publisher, or you can use your favorite local independent bookstore, of course, or your favorite online bookseller. We really hope that the show inspired you to read the book. Your favorite local public library. We hope you consider checking it out, or if they don't have it yet, since it's still a new book, maybe you'll reach out to them and ask them to carry the book and they can order it. So many ways to access this really interesting book. And if you end up reading it, and we hope you do, please reach out to us on Facebook at Critical Thinking for Everyone and let us know what you think. I'm really glad I read it and very thankful for Matt for taking the time to talk with us about it.
Hey everybody, it's Brian, and I just wanted to give a shout out to all the folks here who listen to Forward Radio. We really appreciate you being part of our little community here in Louisville, Kentucky. But you know, it occurred to Patty and me that some folks might just be here for Matt Gatton, international intellectual and archaeologist and inventor and author. Man, he's doing lots of stuff. Anyway, what about Forward Radio? What about the rest of the stuff on Forward Radio? You can get Forward Radio anywhere else you are in the world because we have a live stream. And that's forwardradio.org. Forwardradio.org. And so that's always on. And we have great shows on Forward Radio. We have a lot of national content, great shows like The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. We have a lot of Ralph Nader shows. We have Truth to Power. We have Radio Echo Shock, The Sonic Cafe. Those are some that I like a great deal. But we also have really great local shows. Bench Talk is about science, all kinds of science stuff. Really hands-on and contemporary thinking about that. We have Sustainability Now, flagship show. We got more of those than any other Justin Moggs show. He is a hero, bringing all of the thinkers about sustainability and the activities about sustainability to you. Look, we're already out of time. My goodness gracious. I just want to give a plug for all the great content that's on Forward Radio. It's not just Critical Thinking for Everyone, but Forward Radio is for everyone.
Hey, friends, if you enjoyed that really fun interview with Matt Gatton, then we hope that you will consider donating to Forward Radio during this year's pledge drive.
Oh yeah, we're going to be 7 years old this year.
That's right.
And we sure would love your support, as many 7-year-olds might.
Right. We are running our pledge drive from now through April 13th.
Yep.
And if you would like to donate, you just need to go to
forwardradio.org.
And you will see the button there to donate to our pledge drive. We have wonderful incentives at different levels, but the really true incentive is knowing that you are giving to a radio station that is grassroots.
Yeah, of the people, by the people, for the people.
Right, focused on social justice and education and sustainability and all of these topics that are near and dear to our heart.
Yeah, yeah, and we hope they are to yours too, if you're a regular listener of Forward Radio in particular.
Yeah, so we hope that you will give this year in honor of our 7th birthday. And during our pledge drive, we're happy to take any amount. And if you do, we hope you will give a shout out to Critical Thinking for
Everyone,
which we hope is your very favorite radio show about critical thinking.
That's right. We hope it is the favorite of everyone.
That's right. And we also want to invite you to our 7th birthday party.
Come on out and party with us. It's killer.
Yeah, that's right. It'll be taking place Saturday, April 13th from 5 to 8 p.m. We will be at...
No idea.
Logan Street Market.
Logan Street Market.
And we will have...
all of the amenities of Logan Street Market.
We will have music and surprise guests.
There's tons of food at Logan Street Market. And there's coffee.
Yeah,
and there's a bar.
Handicrafts.
At least one.
Local handicrafts.
I think they have video games.
You get to meet me in person and Brian in person.
You know, I want to give a shout out to Chris, who comes out to Community Composting, Compost Church on Sundays, noon to 2. Hey, Chris, it's great when you come out, and thanks for listening to Critical Thinking for Everyone on Forward Radio. He makes comments about it from time to time.
Really?
One of which is, still haven't met that Patty Payette.
Well, Chris, I'll hope to see you on April 13th. That, and listener, we hope to see you on April 13th.
Oh, yeah, whoever you are, we need you to come out and consider maybe... Again, donating to Forward Radio, forwardradio.org, donate button. You can come to the party even if you don't donate.
Yeah, you could donate and not come to the party. You can come to the party and donate there. Mm-hmm. We're also going to have a silent auction.
You can see how logic is corrupting Patty's thinking. All of these
You can
options.
Also meet Justin Mogg.
Oh, yeah, big deal.
Ruth Newman.
Sure.
Bob Klein.
All kinds of folks.
All your favorite Forward Radio people will be there.
All of the shows will be represented in one fashion or the other.
Yeah.
That is our pledge.
Yeah. So, anyway, we just want you to know this radio station, which is all led by all volunteer steam, the money that we raise is just for things like our computers and our receiver that sits on top of the Hayburn building and all the things that just keep the radio waves flowing. But everything else is just our volunteer work, and we're so proud to be part of the station.
We are, and we really look forward to seeing what you come through with, dear listener.
ForwardRadio.org.
We know you love us. We love you back.
Thank you.